West Legal Aid Center and Celesc welcome you to today's program titled, Are Colleges and Universities on the Hook When Hazing Crosses the Line? Use the participation tab at the bottom of your screen to send a question to the speaker. Program materials are available under the Supplements tab. It's my pleasure to introduce our speaker for today's program, Clifford Readers. Thank you for joining us today. I'll now turn the program over to Mr. Readers.
Good afternoon. Happy to be with a group that I cannot see, but I know must be there somewhere. So this is one of those topics that is about as unusual and arcane as it gets. It's pretty unusual for us to be talking about trial court opinions, whether it be state or federal, because we're all waiting for guidance from the appellate courts. And I know that the provider does not normally do that. So when I was asked to do this program, I was a little bit surprised. But when I reviewed the materials and the article that I had written about hazing, I realized that because there are so few opinions about it, and because one particular district court judge has written on the topic extensively in actually two decisions, plus a number of related decisions within each case, that there was something that was of interest to many people, and that is the extent to which hazing can be actionable. Now, of course, I don't know who's in the audience. I don't know if you represent colleges and universities or individual plaintiffs, but it really doesn't matter because either way, it is a unique and still, I think, undefined area of the law. I think you will be seeing appellate court authority about this with the passage of time. So let's talk first about Humphreys versus Pennsylvania State University. It is by no means the first case on the subject, but it is probably the most extensive. The judge, Matthew Brand, has written other opinions on the subject. I just wanted to grab you so I can give you other citations as well. We have a lot of materials here that are kind of spread out. The judge has also written on the question of hazing as concerns of Bucknell University. This was Pennsylvania State University. You would find the fact of this case shocking, the case of Humphreys versus Pennsylvania State University, as did I. In fact, so shocking that even though I'm no longer a young kid, been in college for a while, and I don't think of myself as a prude, I find it almost difficult to go through some of these facts. But it's important because this case is, but all these cases are very factually intensive. So essentially, Isaiah Humphreys, as my materials indicate, arrived at Penn State in January of 2018. He had a Texas high school career, which he was very successful, and he faced many recruitment efforts on the part of Penn State, which is very aggressive about that sort of thing. Penn State entered the sweepstakes during Humphreys' sophomore year, and the person with whom Humphreys had the most contact was head coach James Franklin. He was offered a full scholarship in February of 2016. 2 years that followed that time, Humphreys traveled to Penn State and Franklin went to Texas, and it was a very intense recruitment effort. You know, college sports, especially at that level, are a business, and it's more than just about college. It's about universities making a tremendous amount of money off these athletes, and likewise, it's about the athletes having an opportunity to play ball almost as though they were in the minor leagues. One of my partners had a son who ended up pitching for the New York Yankees, but he really was discovered pitching at Stanford. And he only spent a short time in the minors after Stanford. So the in terms of football, the colleges like Penn State really are the minor league teams. They ready these people for the major league, so to speak, which I'm sure everybody understands. So it is a business, and it's a sophisticated business, and it's a tremendously money-making business. And I think that's something important to keep in mind as we go through the facts and how the court ruled. Now, throughout the recruiting odyssey, as the judge called it, the Franklin and his staff emphasized that for Humphreys to attend Penn State would maximize his athletic and academic potential. And he was told, very important, keep this in mind, that they would protect him, keep him safe, treat him like a son. Now, are these just words thrown out there? Do they have meaning? Are they actionable? Certainly to parents and to young people that get these scholarships, they take this stuff seriously. After all, 18 years old is still pretty young. No matter how sophisticated or experienced in life or in sports the young person is or their family. Ultimately, after 2 years of courtship, Humphreys accepted Penn State's offer on December 20th, 2017, and again, promises of a family-like atmosphere. Shortly after he arrived, he alleged, and of course, these allegations have to be accepted as true based upon where we are in the pleading stage. Humphreys recounted a number of events that reoccurred frequently with Damian Barber, who, by the way, was left in the case, and others that are named in the complaint. The only one of the players named, as I said, was Damian Barber. The harassment took the form of verbal and physical and was extremely crude. If you have the same numbering system I do, take a look at 1.4. And he was told explicitly that he would be the object of sexual exploits. And of course, he was shocked by it as well. He did not come from a background where he would have expected to be talked to or treated that way at all. And he was told at one point, "I am going to Sandusky you." And I think everybody knows what that means. The players did not stop at verbal threats. And the judge said that some of the details are childish but benign. I don't know how you could read these facts, which the judge does reiterate and say there was anything benign about any of them. The other players, the players' actions, the judge says, are more troubling. Well, I'll say so. Humphreys was wrestled to the ground, sexually harassed while retained. There was simulated humping. His genitals were physically smacked and touched. He indicated how Barber, Gross, Matos, Parsons, Lukita would place their penis on the pin player's buttocks or face and stroke their genitalia. The harassment extended into locker room showers, and they placed their penis between the victim's buttocks. And the court describes these actions in graphic detail. But what's odd is the court's statement that while the descriptions were graphic, in other key aspects, his descriptions are wanting. It is almost as though the judge expected through the complaint proof positive that the court could feel comfortable with. This happened 2 to 3 times per week on average, that this harassment, this hazing, took place. The court was critical because the judge said that it was not clear whether Humphreys was subject to persistent sexual violence 2 to 3 times per week or merely the theft of clothing or detail, which he reported to the coaching staff. So in other words, which one occurred 3 to 4 times a week was not clear to the judge. There was an amended complaint. The plaintiffs actually amended several times based upon prior court orders in which the court acknowledged that additional details were given. So this continued on, and February 18th, March 26th, the court again was critical as to the failure to distinguish between verbal and physical conduct with precise dates that satisfied the court. Finally, on June 14th, there was further misconduct in the locker room, in the football building locker room, and those were threats of specific sexual acts, as well as fondling, that is physical conduct. Now, Humphreys reported this to the coaching staff. He talked to to Coach Franklin, of course, was the head guy, among others. Franklin, however, chastised Humphreys, who pulled a knife, and he told him that he just should have, quote, gotten his ass beat, close quote. At one point, Humphreys was so desperate that he did pull a knife. It seemed to upset the court as well. Franklin ultimately punished both Parsons and Humphreys, with Humphreys being given extra morning workouts, while Parsons was placed on conduct probation through the end of the fall semester. After this report, Humphrey alleged that the four players retaliating continued to haze him. Actually, it was even worse. Humphreys told an assistant coach, Timothy Banks, about the harassment. And Banks said, practice without the drama. Humphrey's father called Banks to discuss his son's mistreatment. And the father was told, Humphreys needs to stop acting as though he was affluent, refined, and sophisticated. And late May, Humphrey's father called Banks again because of physical threats to his son. And there was another incident in June involving Barber and Lukita, and reports that followed that. There was an attempt by a barber to fondle Humphreys in the locker room, but Franklin took no action to afford any protection. And in fact, Humphreys alleged the coaches actually retaliated against him for making reports by unfairly evaluating his performance, scorning him, pitting him against other teammates, censoring him, accusing him of anxiety. Now, I'm taking my time to go through this because it is, again, so important to appreciate what the court seemed to brush aside. Looking back, Humphreys contends the players' hazing and harassment was part of their of this initiation onto the team, so to speak. At least that's the way they looked at it, giving them the benefit of the doubt, if you could do that. There was a model presented to the court of what Humphreys was like and why that might have upset his teammates. He was an accomplished musician, skilled in guitar, piano, and ukulele. He speaks English well with clarity and distinctiveness. He doesn't use vulgarity. He was well-groomed and refined in appearance. He was raised to be compassionate, sensitive, and kind, and not resolve conflicts through violence, and he does not embrace the angry gangster or thug persona. So over the course of time, Humphreys began to suffer physically, anxiety, sleeplessness, depression. At one point, assistant coach even called Humphreys' father because he was concerned that Humphreys was suicidal. Eventually, Humphreys left Penn State. It was not an amicable party. Humphreys said that the staff spoke poorly of him to other football coaches, and Humphreys moved on to the University of California at Berkeley. The court found that there was no negligence, per se, no contractual duty, notwithstanding that the university, the claim was the university turned a blind eye. The court found there was no affirmative duty. The court, notwithstanding a 105-page description, found that the allegations were not sufficient to impose a duty. Now, one of the more interesting and curious facts about the procedural history of this case is a later opinion by the court, Humphreys versus Penn State, which you might want to look at. And that was decided December 7th of 2021, based upon the request of plaintiffs to take an interlocutory appeal. And you read that opinion, and it's one of the more unusual opinions that you will read. The court was clearly irritated by this case, by the bringing of the case, by the criticism of the court, and responded in a way that you, and used language that you would not expect to see, and probably have not seen very many federal judges use. I clerk in the federal court system myself. And regardless of how the judge may have felt about a party or even a claim, the judges I worked for were very careful to maintain a certain aura so that their partiality could never be questioned. The court reviewed the restatement second of tort section 323, as you all know, increased risk of harm, and said that this did not provide authority for the proposition that there was a duty to protect students from violation of university policies, specifically to control football players to conform to their to the behavior of the student code of conduct and administrative policies. No duty. These policies, student code administrative policies, they exist as perhaps to give guidance in some ethical sense, but they do not import any enforceable duty. The court decided that Humphrey's claim failed because the policies that Humphrey invokes provide a general promise of protection, underlying general promise of protection. So the court said it was a distinction between general promise and I suppose specific promise, as opposed to a specific undertaking required by Pennsylvania's restrictive reading of the restatement. Now, I don't think Pennsylvania has read that restatement restrictively, but read the opinion yourself and see what you think. The court considered the argument that a special relationship had been created between the university and its athletes, that provides a basis for the suit. The court looked at a number of Pennsylvania cases, including Felicia versus Lackawanna College, which, by the way, reversed dismissal of a case against the college, where there was lack of medical trained people for athletes. The court actually reversed that dismissal. And the court also looked at Althaus versus Cohen, which is which involved a child who was a victim of parental sexual abuse, and whether the therapist who treats the child for alleged parental sexual abuse owes a duty of care to the child's parents in a therapeutic situation where the child has been abused by the parents. And the court found there was no such duty, and the court relied very heavily on that. Of course, there were no facts there in Althaus to suggest that there was some facts that the therapist had which would have required such a duty to take place. So the and it's also, by the way, Althaus is also a 2000 case, and that's 22 years ago, and the law has advanced substantially. So I think reliance on Althaus may be arguably may be misplaced. And Felicia, which was a 2017 case from the Superior Court, Intermediate Court, a lower court, reversed the dismissal of a case against a college in a much more analogous situation involving, as I said a few minutes ago, medical personnel attending to athletes. But the court, that's what the court did, relied very heavily on Althaus and was dismissive of Felicia. Now, the court said it's one thing to require that schools provide adequate medical services to athletes, as Felicia did. Quite another to require that schools guarantee those athletes safety once they have left the field. The former was targeted, the latter turns the coaches and school coaches into all-purpose insurers of a particular set of students, which, of course, is not what was claimed in this case at all. What's claimed in this case was that there were specific complaints made to the coaches that they had knowledge that this student, Humphreys, was sexually molested. And it wasn't a question of asking them to be insurers, but rather respond to a specific set of circumstances. Judge Brand concluded that the case law did not disturb his findings that Pennsylvania does not impose a what he called a special relationship, which is proper terminology under Pennsylvania law, between colleges and student athletes that would impose a duty of care according to the court. The court examined in great detail the allegations of affirmative conduct of the university and its representatives, the promises made to the plaintiffs, Humphrey scholarship, the party's mutual dependence. Court went through all of that because that's what was utilized by the plaintiff in attempting to demonstrate a special relationship. The court simply found that the affirmative duty asserted in Humphrey's differs from the duty creating conduct identified in Felicia, which was, again, the presence of a medical person in connection with a sporting event, and other cases in Pennsylvania Supreme Court's affirmative duty canon. The facts in this case said the court did not rise to the level of affirmative actions which create a risk and induced reliance. Very difficult to understand that finding, given the specificity of the violence asserted and that we're dealing here with summary judgment. Working hard to make a distinction, the court further rejected the concept that a duty existed with respect to the fact that Penn State was a possessor of land, and that there was a special relationship to users. The court also looked at Pennsylvania's anti-hazing statute. So the anti-hazing statute was passed with great fanfare, and it's a criminal statute. It says a person commits the offense of hazing if the person intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly, for the purpose of initiating, admitting, or affiliating a minor student, or for the purpose of continually enhancing a minor student's status in the organization, causes, coerces, or forces a minor student to do any of the following. And it goes through the a list of elements. There can't be any question that this statute was violated. I don't think one could reasonably say it was not violated. The court nevertheless refused to apply it as a civil standard. One would wonder, funny, I was discussing this with someone else and said to me, wonder why there wasn't a criminal prosecution. Well, I guess you have to know something about Center County. The possibility of a district attorney in Center County bringing a case against the football program of Penn State is just not very likely. And of course, the Sandusky case is proceeded through the Attorney General's office. So the crimes code can be found at 18 Pennsylvania Statute 2802, 03, and through 05. And the court said that that this statute did not import a suggestion of per se negligence or even set a standard. The court did not delve into and said it was not necessary to delve into whether Penn State promoted or facilitated hazing because Humphrey's revised pleadings failed to allege an underlying hazing violation. An incredible statement. The offenses committed against Mr. Humphrey, according to the court, were not part of an initiation process. Although reading the opinion, the court's own language, it certainly sounded like what happened to Mr. Humphreys was crude, unacceptable, repulsive. Now, is the court saying that it wasn't bad enough to be hazing or that it was too bad to be hazing? That it was so horrible that it went beyond hazing, therefore he did not get protection from the statute? You know, I really want to, when I do these programs, I'm talking about an opinion, I really try very hard, normally, not to express my own view of the opinion. Because it's, I'm not sure I have the right to do that or the business to do that. I wasn't there. Well, I've not read the briefs. I've just read a number of opinions. And I'd like to give the court the benefit of the doubt until they're reversed. But it is difficult in reading this opinion to understand. It's difficult for me to understand. You read it yourself and see what you think. How this was not a violation of the anti-hazing statute, or at least an arguable violation, or at least one that a jury had a right to decide. The remainder of the opinion addressed the emotional distress claim. There was a claim for a negligent infliction of emotional distress, an IED claim. And according to the court, there was no prima facie claim of negligence established, and therefore Tony was inapplicable. Well, that is true that if you don't have an underlying claim of negligence, you're not going to have a negligent infliction of emotional distress claim. So the court spent a fair amount of time talking about the NIED claim, but once it already found that there was no negligence on the part of the university or the coach, the NIED claim sort of fall by the wayside. It would appear the conduct suffered by Mr. Humphreys would be precisely the sort of NIED claim the court should entertain, but again, the court found a lack of predicate negligence, what it called weak non-precedential authority, and a lack of a special relationship. The court also found lacking a claim under Title IX. That's Roman numeral IX. We'll talk about that a little bit further. The court relied upon its own prior opinion. In the case of Jean, in the beginning of this program, I tried to find that, but I've got now here. Jean versus Bucknell University, which was a 2021 case, Middle District, PA, September 9th of 2021. So in the same time frame. Bucknell moved to dismiss claims brought against it by one of its students relating to alleged hazing Jean suffered while seeking to join a fraternity on Bucknell's campus. In the original complaint, Jean named Bucknell, claiming negligence, hazing, negligence per se. The court dismissed the claims, holding that the allegations failed to support the claims against Bucknell. The court did so without prejudice, leaving Jean the right to amend. Jean obliged, as we said, and filed an amended complaint, which restated the causes of action against Bucknell, but also included additional allegations. The culture of underage drinking at Bucknell, the school's failure to publish a fraternity recruitment handbook. Bucknell argued that the allegations failed to support the claims against it, and the court agreed and granted the motion to dismiss. So this court here in the Middle District of Pennsylvania, which is going to get a lot of these cases, is just not real warm to the idea that hazing could ever take place. What exactly the court would require that to be is a little bit hard to understand. And the court said to date, no court has specifically addressed the question of how to define facilitate. We're going to get into that a little bit further. Let's see if I have any questions here. No court has specifically addressed the question of how to define facilitate for purposes of section 2804. Let me just pull that up here a minute. Of the Pennsylvania Anti-Hazing Statute. So let's just look at that for a minute. You know, I took a closer look at that each time I read and reread this opinion in preparing this program. You know, I reread it again. And the court fixed on one word, and that was the word facilitate. Because in order to commit the offense of hazing, a person has to, that's one of several possibilities. A person commits the offense of hazing if the person intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly for the purpose of initiating, admitting, or affiliating a minor student into or with an organization, or for the purpose of continuing or enhancing the minor or student's membership, causes, coerces, or forces a minor to do any of the following. Let me give you now what that list is, the following things. Violate federal or state criminal law, consume any food, liquid, alcoholic beverage, drug, or other substance, which subjects the minor to a risk of emotional or physical harm, endure brutality of a physical nature, including whipping, beating, branding, calisthenics, or exposure to the elements, endure brutality of a mental nature, including activity adversely affecting the mental health or dignity of the individual, sleep deprivation, exclusion from social contact, or conduct that could result in extreme embarrassment. But I tell you, this is not number four, I don't know what is. Endure brutality of a sexual nature, which of course is a lot what this case is about. Endure any other activity that creates a reasonable likelihood of bodily injury to the minor or student. So again, it's a criminal statute, but the court in part blamed the plaintiff for being too limited in their 105-page complaint. So should be noted, and I think this is probably why we're here doing this program, that to date, no court has specifically addressed the question of how to define, quote, facilitate, close quote, for purposes of section 2804 of the Pennsylvania Anti-Hazing Statute. So we'll talk about that in a minute, but I do need to give a notice to New York practitioners. And I need to give you the New York code, which I am permitted only to read twice. And so I will do that now. And the code for the other practitioners who do need to report this is C, as in Clifford, R as in readers, CR 3252-21522. CR 3252-21522. That's the code for New York practitioners. And that is my one time permitted reading of it. Okay, so as we started to say a few minutes ago, today no court specifically addressed the question of how to define facilitate for purposes of the Pennsylvania anti-hazing statute, which, by the way, is a statute that has been used in many states. It's a familiar language. Excuse me, we'll have a sip of water here. Federal and state courts have, in certain contexts, endorsed the broad plain dictionary definition of facilitate to make easier that Gene, in the Gene versus Bucknell case, advocated for. However, in the view of the court, Bucknell was correct in asserting that Section 2804 required, quote, the alleged perpetrator to actively contribute to, close quote, rather than merely fail to take action to prohibit hazing. So the court was setting up the decision in Humphreys based upon its holding in Gene versus Bucknell for the fact that even though facilitate in the act which defines hazing, the criminal act defines hazing, the court nevertheless redefined it to say that it is not merely contributing to, but there has to be an affirmative type of action that needs to facilitate, not just create a pathway, but needs to take affirmative action of a nature that makes the court believe, or would make a finder of fact believe, that the action only occurred because the supervisor, so to speak, wanted it to happen. That's pretty much what it comes down to. In Pennsylvania's criminal statute, the precise terminology included in Section 2804, that is, promotes or facilitates, that's the terminology, generally appears in the context of criminal accomplice or conspirator liability, both of which require some level of affirmative action by the defendant. By the way, that's not correct. In fact, a lookout in a bank robbery who does absolutely nothing other than acts as a lookout and therefore potentially could do something that he or she did not really have to do because the eventuality never arose but was stationary as a lookout just in case. That person could be, for example, a teller is shot by one of the folks involved in the bank robbery. Felony murder rule applies. I defended such a case. So I recall that. Now, we can say we're getting a little bit far afield. That may be involved with conspiracy law. But the bottom line is that the court based its structure of these two opinions, Gene versus Bucknell, Humphreys versus Penn State, based its structural approach to the law as requiring something that it called affirmative, rather than the term facilitate as being something which creates an environment which permits something easier to occur, to make easier or less difficult, which would be the normal dictionary definition. As noted, the facts alleged in the amended complaint did not establish that Bucknell was aware, should have been aware, that hazing would occur at the particular event that was at issue in Gene versus Bucknell. At most, the alleged prior instance of hazing by other organizations off Bucknell's campus provide general notice that hazing could occur at some student organization event. Now, of course, not every hazing case is the same. Not every case is the same. And the facts in Humphreys are very specific, in terms of what occurred to the student, the pattern and practice, the fact that even, and this is really a key point, I think, even the coaches were concerned enough about Humphrey's mental state at one point to call his father. So they knew what was going on. It is very clear that it's alleged they knew what was going on. And it's very clear that it is alleged that they not only did not do anything to prevent it, but they, in fact, did encourage it. They took affirmative action by not doing anything to prevent the sexual misconduct from continuing. So absent any indication that Bucknell, at the very least, should have been aware that hazing would occur at this particular initiation event that took place in Jean versus Bucknell, this incident of hazing would not have been foreseeable to Bucknell. So it is a very different case. Yet the court relies upon it for precedent since it's in the same time frame as Humphreys. So, you know, I always like to kind of try to reduce these cases to, you know, what I call bullet points. And, you know, let's just look at sort of the key elements here. Student athlete at Penn State was hazed and harassed by co-athletes on his team. And it certainly was alleged, and it was sexual, it was violent. It was abusive. It was embarrassing. It was repulsive. And it was unacceptable. The court, Chief Judge Matthew Brand, found no negligence claim possible, no duty on the part of the university. He acknowledged that they had knowledge. He said their conduct was not affirmative. He said there was no special relationship, that even as a possessor of land, they had no obligation to their business invitee to root out defects in the land, which, you know, in my view, he's probably right on that one. No negligence per se to afford protection. And of course, for that purpose, you know, that's why he looked at the criminal statute, which he read in a very restrictive manner. No claim under Restatement 323, increased risk harm. And of course, no negligent infliction of emotional distress because he found no negligence. The court found that Tony versus Chester County Hospital, Pennsylvania case, because Pennsylvania law is applicable, recognizing a new NIED claim was not applicable. Had to do some work to find that inapplicable, and they found it inapplicable. Also found that there was no sexual harassment. The court seemed to be influenced by the fact that this was men on men, male on male, and therefore no sexual harassment, although the law is very clear that same-sex harassment is harassment. And is actionable. Court did not find that to be the case. Court, as I said, relied heavily upon Jean versus Bucknell University. And this was a hazing complaint against Bucknell. Court did not find that negligence action was established against Bucknell, just because it knew generally of drinking and hazing incidents. That is a more defensible decision. Here in Humphreys, and I think it's important to contrast these two decisions, same judge, right? In Humphreys, you had very specific misconduct that everybody would agree was misconduct, I think. And the university knew about it, and the university chose basically to tell Humphreys to deal with it. That's, you know, that's what the football life is all about. He should toughen up. And even though later on they expressed concern about Humphreys themselves. So they knew about it. It wasn't like a general knowledge as in the Bucknell situation. Section 2804 of Pennsylvania's anti-hazing statute imposes liability on an organization that intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly promotes or facilitates hazing, which, of course, it was not the case with respect to Bucknell. And the court noted that no other court has defined facilitate for purposes of an anti-hazing statute. And that case, as we said, was dismissed. So I think without question that you'll be seeing more of this. I think that it is highly likely it will be reversed. And a jury will be permitted to hear the development of the facts in order to determine whether there was a sufficient amount of hazing, whether it fit the definition of hazing, and whether the university decided deliberately, to turn a blind eye to it. And Humphreys, not just to turn a blind eye to it, but to believe it was actually a good thing because it would help toughen up this man for the team. Clearly what they were all about. Now, it's worthwhile to take a look at something that, so I always do when I look at these cases, I never just stop with the case. Take a look at, kind of what happens thereafter, the old Paul Harvey rest of the story. So there is a later case that I found almost as interesting as the initial case from Judge Brandt, Humphreys versus Penn State, December 7th, 2021. I mentioned that earlier. So what happened here is the judge left in Barber, who was a fellow student. And I think the way the judge looked at this case is, okay, Barber did some really terrible things, but, I'm going to protect Penn State, Penn State's coaching staff, but, let the hammer fall on Barber. He was the one who really, he did the actions. He did the act. So I'll let that case go forward. And in what I found to be just an incredible opinion, and maybe, I don't know, maybe you'll disagree with it. Read the opinion. So again, I give you the date of it. Humphreys versus Penn State, Middle District of Pennsylvania, December 7th, 2021. You can get certainly on Westlaw very easily. Just put it in there. So the plaintiffs wanted to take an interlocutory decision. And they filed for an interlocutory decision. So the court basically revisited its opinion and revisited the case law. And in a way that only can be described as angry. And the sort of goes through some key points here. I think it's important. The court, of course, and correctly so, said that interlocutory relief is atypical. Now, I'm not going over this for the purpose of doing a separate analysis of interlocutory appeals. I mean, that's a subject for another day. But in indicating why it did not, why it didn't feel interlocutory appeal was appropriate, the court looked at its opinion and explained it further. So it had to explain Gene versus Bucknell and Humphreys versus Penn State, but it never did that. It never contrasted those two opinions, which I thought was really very interesting. But it nevertheless did go through its reasoning once again. And starting off with Title IX, the court referred to the claim as sex stereotyping, gender-based harassment theory, as opposed to the very simple same-sex harassment, which is the way it's normally discussed. So the court was very negatively affected by what it viewed as criticism of its decisions. The court said, to start, I fail to see how merely having referred to himself using male gender pronouns in his complaint would transform Humphrey's allegations about his teammates' abuse into gender-motivated abuse. So he does not see the fact that Humphrey's was physically touched and abused in connection with his genitals. The judge did not see that as gender-based motivation. This approach would erase any distinction between conduct and gender-motivated conduct. The allegations about the coach's conduct failed, not because he didn't allege allegations that could be considered retaliatory, but because he failed to engage even on a surface level with causation. And then the court goes on to say, but the flimsiness of these arguments is beside the point. So isn't it the point? If it's beside the point, then what is the point? The court does not say that. Then the court goes on, takes a real personal swipe. As has been a persistent theme throughout this suit, Humphrey's framing of the issue misses the mark. Whether I gave an adequate weight to these paragraphs in the complaint, could rightfully be the topic of an appeal, but it's the wrong track here. And the court then goes on to talk about the controlling questions of law as not being sufficient to permit an interlocutory appeal. So the court was also very offended that the plaintiff took the position that the court ignored the plain language of the Timothy J. Piazza anti-hazing law. Quote, put bluntly, I did not address the continue, enhance, or affiliate elements of the statute. That's the language of the statute, continue, enhance, or affiliate, because Humphrey's complaint failed to assert them. And in spite of this 105-page complaint that the court criticized earlier as being, you know, very long, and I guess there were four versions of it, the court found that in each of the complaints, Humphrey alleged that the harassment he endured was part of his initiation. And the Piazza law is not limited solely to initiation. And it can be shown that hazing was part of continuing or enhancing Humphrey's status on the team. So the court believed that this was a new theory and that the use of the word initiation did not cover the other events that are part of the anti-hazing statute. The court does acknowledge that there are differences of opinion about many aspects of the Piazza law, but the issues raised by Humphrey do not qualify. And it certainly seems as though the interpretation and understanding of the anti-hazing law is a very, very key factor. One that actually the Third Circuit might even want to defer to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, which it has done. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court has on a number of occasions, I've been amicus curiae in some of them, has deferred its decision to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court seems certainly willing to take on the burden when asked to by the Third Circuit. So, you know, the judge did not feel the anti-hazing statute apparently presented a controlling issue. The court also discussed and rediscussed the negligence theory. Once again, it went through the special relationship theory, and it addressed a criticism of the court that it applied too strict a standard to the pleadings. The court, of course, did not agree to that. It was an interesting case, the Klein Connect versus Gettysburg College case, a Third Circuit case in which the Third Circuit predicted that the Pennsylvania Supreme Court would find a duty creating special relationship between an athlete and their schools and coaches. Okay, so the Third Circuit so found that in Klein Connect. But we've already discussed, you'll recall, Felicia versus Lackawanna College, in which the Superior Court reinstated a claim when there were not medical folks available for athletes. Now, the court, therefore, had to work really hard to distinguish the Third Circuit and Pennsylvania Superior Court. It said the Third Circuit in Klein Connect dealt with a more narrow issue, which was the presence of qualified medical personnel. But what was important about Klein Connect is that it found a duty between the college and the athlete. That's what was important about it, not necessarily what that duty was, because this court, the Humphreys Court, clearly had to reject that there was ever or there ever could be a duty between the college, a special relationship between the college and the student athlete. The court used this explanation. In my recent decision, I explained why even if you could fit Humphreys, listen to this, elephant size theory into Klein Connect's medical personnel at sporting event size mouse hole, Klein Connect was no longer a prediction to follow blindly in the wake of Althaus versus Cone. Now, Althaus versus Cone, of course, is a completely different situation involving a therapist duty to inform parents of knowledge that the therapist had. And Althaus has nothing to do with, of course, the obligation of a university or a college. But Althaus is reflective of how Pennsylvania analyzes when a duty should exist. And Althaus is cited over and over again in terms of creation of duty, most of which you would think would be met in this case. So a plaintiff apparently irritated this court very much by, in the judge's view, baldly claiming that the court's interpretation of Kleineck's scope tosses aside the Third Circuit precedent as non-binding authority, which, of course, is just what the judge did. Kind of reminds me of a story. One of the judges I worked for was bald. Judges could be unusual, right? And things could really irritate them. And boy, it'd make him mad when somebody used the term baldly. And I just laughing about this because, you know, look back on it, it's funny. At the time, it wasn't so funny, but he would change it to merely. So be careful about using the term baldly, or at least know whether your judge has hair. But anyway, the court refers to plaintiff's argument that the district court was disregarding Third Circuit authority as a swipe. So the court does have that Third Circuit question to deal with, and that's why I think the Third Circuit is likely to hear this case and high probability of reversal. So so we can go through these cases in some detail. The court also attempts to say that Felicia, the Superior Court case, the medical folks at the sporting event case, is not controlled by existing authority. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court said the court has not decided whether a specific duty exists. Let me read it to you exactly. For one, comma, that Pennsylvania Supreme Court has not decided whether a specific duty exists does not catapult a claim into unsettled law territory. So what the court is saying is just because Felicia reversed throwing out the case where the school didn't have medical personnel at the sporting event didn't mean that they recognized the duty. Okay, with me on that? Just because the Superior Court reversed the tossing out of a case where it was claimed there should have been medical personnel at a sporting event doesn't mean that Felicia, that Superior Court, necessarily established a duty. No, what it did is it said the jury can decide, however, whether a duty exists under the circumstances of that case. The court said, the district court here, balked at extending a lesser duty in Felicia. And so, again, all the Superior Court did there was send the case back. That's what appellate courts do. The court also, in this opinion on interlocutory appeal, discussed negligent infliction of emotional distress and negligent infliction of emotional distress, the NIED claim. And finally, the court found that it would not advance the ultimate determination of litigation, because there was still one person left. And the court said, I remember noting this, because this was really funny or different or whatever, that it was up to the plaintiff to settle with, get rid, or dismiss the sole remaining party, that is the barber, the other student, and then they could take their appeal. The court kind of gave them that advice. And this is what the court said. Whether there's a final judgment remains very much in his own hands. If it's Penn State and Franklin that he's after, this is a court speaking. If it's Penn State and Franklin that he's after, he can wrap up his case against Barber and proceed to the Third Circuit. So how the court thinks it should be wrapped up, either by a trial or by dismissing Barber, maybe, what the court was trying to exact out of plaintiffs is not exactly clear, but essence suggested that they could make this a final, if their real target is Franklin and Penn State, why don't you get rid of Barber? Maybe it's good advice, but not the kind of advice you'd expect to see in an opinion. So court found that there were not sufficient facts to warrant certification. And I don't know, obviously, I have no idea what the plaintiff's intent is here, but I would think that they may very well want to take the judge's advice and get rid of Barber and proceed to the Third Circuit. So the question, I believe, as to whether hazing is actionable under the circumstances, the kind of circumstances that exist in this case, I think is very much alive. But there are now two presidential opinions, Gene versus Bucknell and Humphreys versus Penn State, weighing in against the concept that a university can be parens patriae, if you will, or be in a position of responsibility, notwithstanding that they actively and strongly and aggressively recruited this player, promised him specifically protection, not only did not provide that protection, but when they found out explicitly that the student was being grotesquely sexually abused, essentially told him to toughen up, even though they were concerned enough about the student's mental state to call his father about it. The court found none of that could create a duty because the court was apparently is uncomfortable with the concept of a university or a college having the role or potentially having the role of safeguarding the interests of a student. Maybe the court is worried about, you know, floodgates theory. There's all kinds of emotional and other problems that students have on campus that their parents or they might bring to the attention of the university. There's probably all kinds of harassment that occurs, particularly in a big place like Penn State. And maybe the court was just felt it was protecting the university from the floodgates being open. What makes this case a little different is that this is somebody that was specifically recruited for a highly organized and financially productive part of the university's business. Where the university did have, it's alleged and apparently acknowledged, very specific information about what was going on with the student and did make a conscious decision not to protect the student, but rather to put the onus on the student to grow up. So I think that it's a very interesting topic, whether our students deserve more protection than that under circumstances where university and colleges have specific information, or whether we're going to say, no, their job really is to make as much money off the sporting program as they can, and we're not going to let these sissies, you know, weigh them down with their complaints. Now, depends how you look at it, and I'm sure we'll hear more about it in this case and perhaps other cases. So that pretty much wraps up what I have to say. I'm happy to sort of address any questions that there might be. I think that we all need to recall, I'm not sure what state you're from, that this was decided under Pennsylvania law. But I think the Pennsylvania law principles are really quite general in this case. The anti-hazing statute is a very common statute. The language is been used in many states. It's almost a uniform piece of legislation. And the general duty of universities, to what extent that duty applies or does not apply, again, is very general. Interestingly enough, other than the health officials at sporting events, there's really not a lot of law on that either. And most of those cases say that there could be a duty, something the court had a hard time in this case distinguishing. So I urge you to read up on the subject, stay in touch with it, stay tuned, and I'm happy to entertain any further comments, questions, thoughts, either now or if you'd like to email me. My email, I don't know if it's given to you or not, but my email is creeders, CRIEDERS, I before E, creeders at readerstravis.com. Remember, IE both times, creeders at readerstravis.com. So I hope everybody stays well, stays healthy, and take care. Thank you very much for listening in, and be well.